All right, thank you. Well, not everyone got up and left, so that's a good sign that there's some interest in this topic. And those of you familiar with the literature know that this type of research goes a long way back. We've been working on these systems for years, and it's kind of been intermittent throughout history. But I think the one great thing is that for every failure that we've had, we've also had a success in developing these systems. And even though we might view them as failures, we're actually have learned quite a bit about the do's and don'ts of perennial ground cover systems. Let me first acknowledge my co-authors. Ken Moore was my major professor when I was at Iowa State. Dr. Kendall Lamke and Dr. Jeremy Singer also played a part in this project because they were the ones who got together and funded this, to get funding for this particular project. And I'm going to kind of get into how large the scope of this actual project was. But the problem we're trying to address here is that with increased efficiency of converting cellulosic material into ethanol, or just the use of cellulosic material for possibly things like coal burning, that removal of that corn stover is becoming more and more appealing just because, you know, hey, that's a little added extra income per acre. But as you know, we really rely, especially in Iowa, on that corn residue to stabilize that soil throughout the winter. And throughout the spring until we plant. And so removing it's really going to create a problem in terms of soil erosion and just decreasing the quality of the soil. So one of the things that we've suggested over and over and over again over the years is the use of a perennial ground cover, or which a lot of times is referred to in the literature as a living mulch. And I kind of define it a little different here. I define it as an annual or perennial plant that's interseeded with a row crop to confer some type of ecological, economical, or environmental benefit to that system. And I put annuals in there because a lot of times we are relying on that annual crop to reseed itself so that the cover itself is actually perennial, even though the plant itself is annual. So potential benefits. We've seen reductions in soil runoff as high as 95% in the literature. Weed suppression, reduction of insect pests, and that's primarily by harboring predatory insects within those covers. Increased microbial biomass just from having all that root mass that's there year in and year out. And in some cases, we've actually seen things such as increases in arbuscular mycorrhizal colonization of roots. And then the last thing, and this is... this is not always the case, but with certain species, we are actually seeing an increase in soil moisture, suggesting that the amount of evaporation from the soil surface is much greater than the evapotranspiration that we're getting from some of these canopies. So throughout the literature, you'll see several instances of where that was the case. To kind of give you an idea of the scope of this project, Ken, Kendall, and Jeremy got together and they proposed this project. We would go through and we'd look at corn genetics. Kendall Lamke and his graduate student actually looked at 50 crosses and evaluated them to see how well they would actually grow with a bluegrass or a white clover sod to try to identify, could we actually develop a variety that could tolerate a perennial ground cover. And then there was the crop management aspect of that, and that was Dr. Singer's work. And he was primarily looking at ways to suppress that sod, or ways to use strip tillage or no-till as a means to work with this perennial ground cover in corn production. And then my project, and the one that Ken brought me on board, graciously brought me on board to work on at Iowa State, was actually the evaluation of these species. And we ended up evaluating 35 different grasses and legumes. So our project was considered a split block in time. We had 35 species plus control. We went across three different landscape positions, a summit, a slope, and a toe slope, replicated three times across 3 years. And so you can imagine in Iowa it's kind of hard to find, especially when you get up above the Des Moines Lobe, is to find some slope to actually do that type of research with. So this was a pretty big project. Each one of these blocks was roughly 2 acres. And we had three blocks. The mulch we established in 2006 and 2007, I got to Iowa State in 2007 and not all of the mulches had established well. And we think that was probably due to the lack of good seed-to-soil contact. And so I came back in and I tried the tie drill, which is a no-till drill, and we got pretty good emergence. But when I came back that fall and used a Brilliant Seeder and really packed that soil down, I got excellent establishment of just about all the species that I tried. There were a couple in there that still had trouble with. Corn planting dates, we planted Pioneer 34A20, which is 109-day maturity. And we planted on May the 19th, May the 14th, in 2008 and 2009, respectively. And we had a very wet springs. That's the reason why we were actually pushing up to the end of May. And then April the 21st, we were actually able to get in a little earlier in 2010. Planted corn at about 80,000 plants per hectare. We tried to shoot for fall strip tillage, but a lot of times in the fall after we got the corn out, the ground would be frozen. It was very, very difficult to always get it in the fall. And so in 2008 and 2009, we actually strip tilled in the spring. Now in the fall of 2009, we were able to get back in there and strip till that crop for 2010. The type of data we collected was grain yield, the stover yield, the population at harvest, ear counts, plant heights at two-week intervals, and that usually started at about V6. Spring ground cover, which we estimated using a reflectance, so the vegetative index, NDVI, the normalized difference vegetation index, and fall ground cover, which we analyzed using digital image analysis because a lot of that had browned off and had reflective properties similar to the soil. And then we also had soil fertility data, which I'm not going to be talking about much today. So the species, I kind of grouped them according to kind of a functional group. But the first group are what I would call joining grasses. A lot of your native cool season grasses, crested wheatgrass, slender wheatgrass, Canada wild rye, riverbank wild rye, and Virginia wild rye. And then we get into more of the turf type bent grass species, and I won't go through all of them, and where I have a variety type, I've listed it there. Then we had the fine leaf fescues, also common in turf and ornamental. And then we have what I would classify as coarse leafed cool season grasses, the fescues and perennial ryegrass. The weedy species is how I kind of group these guys together, the creeping foxtail and meadow foxtail. I think if you got down to the soil and whispered either one of these names, you'd probably pop up with just in a few days. That's how weedy these species are. I would never put them in another trial like this. And then we have the bluegrasses. We actually had five different types of bluegrass that we looked at in this trial. We had our warm season grasses. For the most part, these were a failure after the first year. They just could not compete with weed pressure within the row. And I think the shading also had a big part of that the first year. We also had our legumes. And then last are kind of the oddballs, the tufted hair grass, prairie June grass, and Harding grass. So right off the bat, there's some things that were significant, things that I observed right out in the field that I found very, very interesting. First of all, only 19 of these species actually survived a full 3 years of this study. Strip tillage could be very, very ineffective in the first year. And if you can imagine trying to go into a bluegrass lawn and establish a strip till, sometimes it looked like you ran a butter knife through it. I mean, strip till could be so difficult. And so we might end up strip tilling two or three times within a day just trying to develop these strips through there. And it was actually in the years after that, once we had that bare soil established, that the strip tills strip tillage was actually more effective. Another thing is that if we had to delay corn planting like we did in 2008 and 2009 up until the middle of May, we gave those C3s a pretty good competitive advantage on that corn, and you'll see how that all played out as the season progressed. Other things is signs of stress would occur shortly after emergence in every year. I know a lot of the work that we've done with perennial ground covers has looked at using species that would possibly be dormant in summer. We'd try to shy away from the warm season grasses and stick with the cool season grasses. But it would, the effect of those cool season grasses was almost right off the bat evident in that those seedlings that came up. You'd see striped leaves and chlorosis, so the stress was there almost immediately, and it wasn't water stress because we had ample water in the spring, and it wasn't nutrient stress because those were ample as well. So this is where we kind of get into light quality issues within that corn canopy and the effect that perennial ground covers have on altering that light quality. And then the other thing is we would notice that there'd be variation just within a block, and I would be standing out looking at these blocks, and all of a sudden I'd see this corn plant that would be a couple of feet taller than the plant right next to it. And when you walked upon that corn plant, what you would find is it was associated with just a little more bare soil, where some of the ground cover species would be right up against the corn. If you had 6-8 inches of a buffer region around that corn plant, it tended to pop right up and look really, really good. So again, I think we're dealing with some light quality issues that are constraining us very early on in the year. So I kind of boiled these tables down. There's still a lot of data on here. But when we look in 2008, we see that grain yield was, at least in these species up here, was significantly less than what we had in the control at 9.1 megagrams of dry matter per hectare. And the rest, I didn't show the rest of these species in here, but they kind of follow suit here. But when you get down into the creeping foxtails, the meadow foxtails, red top, upland bentgrass, things that tend to grow really, really tall, and things that tend to encroach right back into that row, you really start to affect grain yield. And so we start looking at, it's 23% and 37% decrease, and grain yield among those top four yielding species, and a 77 to almost 99% in the bottom four. So when we look at things like harvest index, we see that harvest index was significantly less in those bottom three species. Population was also decreased significantly in those bottom four species. And then we had ears per plant that was also significantly affected in those bottom species. So these species that were very competitive and got back over in their row and shaded, they're primarily reduced yield through that means. In 2009, pretty much the same story. First species that we had in 2008 actually died out, and the ones in 2009, they just kind of all shifted up. But we still have our four species actually bringing up the bottom of the pack here. And you can see similar reductions in yield and grain. Harvest index also significantly reduced in these lower three. Population, again, has taken a hit. And ears per plant also is significantly reduced in these. So it wasn't across all species. The other species were just looking at poor growing conditions. It wasn't related to any of the yield components or population. This is another interesting relationship that popped up, and is that when we'd go in and take plant heights early in the season, you wouldn't see a relationship with final grain yield in terms of height. But by day 42, you could see these relationships starting to take place, meaning that that plant, the yield was being determined very early on from the way it appears from the plant height data, again suggesting that that red-far-red ratio affecting that plant or light quality had a big effect on this. Okay. Just real quick, ground cover. Everything kind of sustained at least 50% or more ground cover throughout the years. So in conclusion, the higher yields were usually achieved by the lower growing species, your bluegrasses and your finally fescues. Selection of overly aggressive species had significant effects to populations, ears per plant, appeared to be seed set. Cooler spring conditions definitely give these systems fits because it gives those C3s a competitive advantage. And I think shade avoidance is definitely a factor. These are the species that I would choose from this: meadow fescue, colonial bentgrass, Canada bluegrass, and foul bluegrass. And these are kind of the characteristics: the shade tolerant, sod forming, low growing, and late green up to stay out of that And just as an example, I love showing this slide. This is Nimblewheel. It's a shade-tolerant C4 grass that has a late green up in the spring. Put this in corn, strip-tilled it to 12-inch row width, and I grew 193 bushel corn in Nimblewheel. And I think the biggest reason because of that is because it wasn't visible to the plant in terms of changing light quality early on in the season. So I think it's something worth looking at, some of these warm season grasses. So we went just a little bit over.
Okay. Let's thank Scott. We've got time for one quick question. Any questions or comments?
Yes. No, 150 pounds of nitrogen, that was it. It's 150 pounds per acre.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Oh, thank you.